The goddess is alive and magic is afoot. Mormon Pagan Women in the 21st Century. A presentation by Doe Daughtry with a response by John Dewey Remy.
All right, good morning. I want to welcome everyone here bright and early to Sunstone to this session entitled The Goddess is Alive and Magic is Afoot, Mormon Pagan Women in the 21st Century. First of all, we're going to hear from Doe Daughtry. Oh, actually, first of all, let me remind everyone to turn off their cell phones, if you don't mind. Second of all, not the most important thing. Okay, we'll hear from Doe Daughtry, who's going to present our paper. Doe is a PhD student at Arizona State University. She has 5 children, 4 grandchildren, and a wonderful husband. She's interested in new and alternative religions in America, especially Mormonism, New Age, Neo-Paganism, and Wicca. And then responding to Doe will be John Remy. And John Remy is a student, writer, and half-Japanese LDS religious eclectic, or so he defines himself. So what we're going to do is go ahead and hear from Don and... We'll go ahead and hear from Doe, and then John will respond afterwards. And so make note of any questions we'll have, and after we hear from them, we'll go to the Q&A.
Okay, this paper is one part of an ongoing project leading to my doctoral dissertation, which I will begin researching and writing more seriously next January. More broadly, my dissertation will examine women's movement from hierarchical to non-hierarchical religious traditions, specifically from Mormonism to various expressions of New Age, Neo-Paganism, and Wicca. And I thought I would explain what those terms mean. New Age and Neo-Paganism are both umbrella terms that cover a variety of traditions. Neo-Paganism involves a revival and adaptation of pre-Christian practices, mainly European, but also Egyptian, Greek, and African. It can be everywhere from Celtic Druidry, Greek Reconstructionism, Nordic Asatru, and Wicca, which is the most popular and comprises the most numerous, is the largest of the traditions. And Wicca is a neo-pagan witchcraft reconstruction. It's a religion that involves the practice of witchcraft. Most practitioners call themselves witches, but not all witches consider themselves Wiccan, or the adherents to the religion of the religion. All of those are contested terms, and depending on who you talk to, which really expresses the individualism and of the traditions. Neo-paganism is polytheistic, and there are various interpretations of what that means, but always involves recognition of a god and goddess, and where that goes after that just depends. There's often more or less interest, more or less emphasis on the goddess. Very individualistic, egalitarian, and ritual-based. Sarah Pike says that ritual is the touchstone of religious identity and community in these traditions. So, I'm less concerned with New Age here. My interest in Mormonism and New Age has to do with the recognition that there are, for every aspect of New Age, there's an analogy in Mormonism. And that's what first got me interested in this topic, was I started realizing that if you kind of break down New Age and look at the different elements of New Age, that I can see, for instance, health and healing. Well, I can see the word of wisdom, and half the people in my ward sell herbs of one kind or another. And so that's what really started my interest in this. I need to find my first page, first couple of pages. Okay. I bought Michael Quinn's book, Early Mormonism and the Magical Worldview, shortly after its release. I distinctly remember reading it at the time when I was just awakening to the issues that consume me now as a scholar, as a Mormon, and as a human being. His book was part of my awakening, which largely took place in the Princeton Second Ward, the ward that served the university's rich and diverse student population. Up to that point, I had heard few details about Sunstone in the LDS intellectual community, other than that it was dangerous, really dangerous, and a resource and a community to be avoided, so I avoided it. But Princeton opened my eyes and my world, and Michael Quinn was definitely a part of that opening. While in the Princeton ward, I became close friends with a woman who had been born into an LDS Puerto Rican family and whose matriarch, her grandmother, read tarot and engaged in other indigenous forms of divination. Having survived a brutal marriage and divorcing her abusive husband, she was remarrying into our ward and beginning to revisit these areas of her life as both a reclaiming of her heritage and as a tool for her own personal empowerment. She told me stories of her life, including routine experiences with the spirit world, which reinforced my awareness of the diversity of Mormon spirituality. However, it wasn't until I began work on my master's thesis, which was about the iconology of the Mother in Heaven, that I really started discovering more about women's spirituality and goddess worship. And that's really where I started making these connections, you know, with New Age first. So I went to Quinn's text to better understand what might have been early Mormon women's engagement with the magical elements of Mormonism's intersection with local folk culture. Toward the end of his text, Michael reveals that in the 1980s, LDS women in the Salt Lake Valley still read tea leaves, cards, and used crystals and seer stones for divination and healing, implying some sort of a continuity of divinatory practice that originated in early Mormonism. If this was not the case, at least it was interesting that this was still going on. This revelation left me very excited to know just what these women were doing. Given the increased Western cultural interest in and social recognition of women's spirituality and goddess worship, I speculated that if some LDS women in Utah were reading cards and using crystals, others were doing the same things in other places, though perhaps or likely not as a practice directly associated with that of early Mormons. One of the main disciplinary goals of religious studies is to present information about what a religious tradition says about itself, as well as to reveal the inherent diversity of insider views. In addition, religious studies provides insights into an analysis of what others say about religious traditions and offers non-religious explanations for religious phenomena. This analysis inevitably raises questions about related issues, for example, social, cultural, and economic issues. Knowing something about LDS women who are what Janet Binion calls double dippers, Mormons who double dip into other cultural and religious pots to either supplement, complement, or replace mainstream Mormonism, can add to several larger religious studies conversations, such as those about new religious movements, conversion, religious change, virtual religion, religious studies, epistemologies, and religious identity. I seem to share my interest in Mormons and broad New Age ideas with the Sunstone community, given that each symposium for the last several years has included papers and panel discussions on these topics. For instance, a 2002 Sunstone panel discussion put together by Lisa Hansen, which she titled Current Research in the Quest for Personal Meaning, enabled panelists and participants to explore the ways in which they, quote, relate their experiences with New Age ideas to their gospel roots, end quote. These New Age experiences included the concept of past lives, divination, synchronicity, and human potential in relation to higher capacities such as ESP. Even topics that might seem to some as being more theologically orthodox fall under the rubric of reconciling Mormon beliefs about magic and what constitutes a magical worldview. For instance, the question of what happens when Mormons do stuff, the ways in which the LDS Church and its members conceptualize the efficacy of ordinances, was explored in a 2001 paper called Defending Magic, Explaining the Necessity of Ordinances. This paper outlined theories of efficacy and addressed the Western notion that ordinances are, quote, symbolic. In other words, the question in this context is, how do rituals work? Through symbolic means, or do they really do something? Put still another way, what forces are at work when we restart a sacrament prayer or repeat a baptism? Or are ordinances, prayers, etc., a way of actually having an effect in the world and the world beyond? And if so, how does that work? If not, what does that mean? Some of the other more recent panels and papers include one called Real Goddesses Have Curves. Some of the panelists talked about goddesses and Heavenly Mother. There was a panel discussion at both at Sunstone in Salt Lake and in Arizona this year called Excavating the Divine Feminine. So this is kind of has become a ubiquitous topic. It seems to be of interest in the larger Sunstone community. It's difficult to know which is more distressing to the institutional LDS Church and to Latter-day Saints at large, the implication that a magical Mormon worldview might mean that Mormonism is occult and archaic or unmodern, or that such a worldview implies or perhaps even conveys a non-Christian pagan identity. Because, you know, what's so interesting is if you put Mormon, if you do a Google search on Mormon and pagan or Mormon pagan, most of what comes up is evangelical Christian Christians calling Mormons pagans. So those pagan temple rituals, those they're pagan. They believe in more than one God. They're pagan, you know. So anyway, arguing for the continued existence of a magical Mormon worldview, both Michael Quinn and Dan Vogel raise the concern that 20th century Mormons have been disenchanted right along with the rest of Western culture, so that many dispute the evidence for that magical worldview. In part, this disagreement arises because the Church is trying to break its association with occult practices by advertising Mormonism as a religious combination of naturalism and pragmatism, as something that works socially and is congruent with science, but isn't mystical or New Age, and is also, of course, decidedly Christian rather than pagan. This rationalist shift is obvious at the local level. Studies show that LDS beliefs about the efficacy of garments have changed, whereas I would argue that most Mormons of my generation categorically believed in the mystical power of garments to protect based on personal worthiness. Today's younger Mormons tend to see garments as symbolic rather than efficacious in any real sense. Thus, when confronting our magical worldview, we fall into the trap of projecting our own modern interpretations of ordinances, materials, and events onto Joseph's time and context, and are embarrassed by the notion that Joseph could have really looked into a hat to see the Book of Mormon. We want translation to be just that, whatever we think that means today, without hats, seer stones, or other magic. Another aspect of the interpretation problem has to do with external attacks made by critics of the Church. LDS apologists have found one way of dealing with and responding to associations critics make between the magical Mormon worldview and Satanism or occult practices is to situate LDS belief and practice in historical context. One example of this response is the Fair paper titled Inverted Stars on LDS Temples from 2002. Which details various historical interpretations of five-pointed stars and contextualizes their cultural use in early Christianity, early America, and early Mormonism, and reminds readers of the pentacle's previously undemonic meaning and its 19th-century identification with evil by a defrocked French Catholic deacon. Other articles argue that because this symbol wasn't associated with Satan or evil in the time of their construction, critics of the Church are mistaken by projecting that association back into its early use. Thus, we can argue against interpreting pentacles on the Salt Lake and Nauvoo temples as relating to magic or as a satanic or otherwise evil symbol, while at the same time arguing for the historic and sacred nature of the symbol. In other words, the question is not that magic doesn't exist, but that it operates through approved channels, which we don't call magicians, but prophets. In 2001, Publishers Weekly reported the rise in divination sales and noted two interesting and seemingly unrelated reports. New Age materials in all areas have increasingly expressed, quote, goddess, Wiccan, and other predominantly female themes, end quote, and that science fiction authors are more likely to be LDS than any other religion. That's all on the same page. The article quoted an informant as saying that, quote, Mormons have an outlook on God and the universe similar to science fiction writers that other Christian churches do not, end quote. This outlook, I would argue, involves that magical worldview, and is why the group of LDS women I interviewed have sought out New Age and women's spirituality resources to supplement or replace what they find missing in Mormonism. It is also why they find their hybrid spirituality at least somewhat congruent with traditional Mormonism, if not institutional Mormonism of the 21st century. It's important to try to understand the LDS Church's position on this issue of what I call Mormon pagan or Mormo-pagan identity or identities. And you know what? I'm just going to skip all of that, I think. Well, maybe I'll read a little of it. In truth, it's hard to know where such an identity begins to take shape. Becoming LDS is a process of conversion, of course, regardless of one's age, but what does it mean to convert to something? It's clear from looking at some Latin American communities that their conversion to Catholicism was less conversion than it was hybrid combination of traditions. LDS conversion is less pliable because of the centralization and standardization of virtually all aspects of Mormonism. Tradition in the LDS Church associates conversion with the experience of coming to know that Joseph Smith had a vision, restored the true Church of Jesus Christ, and translated the Book of Mormon, which is an historical document. This experience gets articulated as a testimony that the Church is true. Explanations for why human beings in any given time or place are religious, engage in religious behaviors, or choose to affiliate with a particular tradition generally come from either theological or secular sources. The Church's theological explanations for conversion focus on the witness of the Holy Ghost to the truthfulness of the knowledge with no particular hierarchy in terms of which aspect of testimony should develop first. Some individuals join the LDS Church because of their engagement with the Book of Mormon. Still others convert because they come to accept as true Joseph Smith as the restorer of the lineage of prophets and priesthood authority, LDS teachings about human potential, or the concept of forever families. Others come to a more subtle, gradual realization that they know the Church is true because it is congruent with their previously held view of the world. After gaining a testimony, the next step of conversion is for individuals to actually join the Church, becoming a part of the covenant relationship with God. They become saints. A large part of acquiring religious identity has to do with situating oneself in relationship to others. Institutional sources are provided to address such questions of identity. In the case of New Age and related ideas and practices, little has actually been provided by the LDS Church. Interestingly enough, some of what has been provided to the general church member comes not from high-level authorities, but is presented in essay or question-and-answer format in church magazines. One such example is an excerpt from a 1996 Ensign I Have a Question column. The question is, I am bothered by certain activities associated with Halloween. How can parents make Halloween a fun time while avoiding practices and behaviors that may grieve the spirit? The answer from a visiting teacher in Willard, Utah, quotes Boyd K. Packer's and James E. Faust's warnings against, quote, the dark side of spiritual things, and the mischief of devil worship, sorcery, casting spells, witchcraft, voodooism, black magic, and all other forms of demonism, end quote. A 1979 essay in the New Era by Terry G. Moyer is titled, Questions Astrologers Avoid Like Cancer. Moyer argues that astrology, quote, is an ancient form of magic and Satan's counterfeit for real prophecy, end quote. Again, it's not that we dispute that we can do this stuff or that this is real. It's that it's just not the right channels. It's not the right format. In 1991, R. Kim Davis, bishop and associate professor of surgery at the University of Utah, noted in the Ensign that, quote, some aspects of the New Age movement may seem harmless, but when we compare basic principles of the gospel with New Age philosophies, we see that New Age beliefs can lead us away from our Heavenly Father, allowing us to rationalize behavior and become ensnared in sin, end quote. The church curriculum brings forward other earlier prophetic warnings. In the teachings of Presidents of the Church, Joseph F. Smith, stand by the truth lest you be deceived from the life of Joseph F. Smith. Church members are warned to be aware of false teachings and false spirits, noting specifically that, quote, when visions, dreams, tongues, prophecy, impressions, or any extraordinary gift or inspiration convey something out of harmony with the accepted revelations of the church or contrary to the decisions of its constituted authorities, Latter-day Saints may know that it is not of God, no matter how plausible it may appear. Anything at discord with that which comes from God through the head of the church is not to be received as authoritative or reliable, end quote. President Smith mentions imitation miracles and goes on to equate witchcraft with evil, reassuring members that there is no power in it, quote, only as it is believed in and accepted, end quote. Thus, President Smith confirms other Ensign and New Era sources that witchcraft is an element of indigenous religious traditions all over the globe, belief in which missionaries and local authorities have to confront continually. Most often, then, church leaders use scripture to make the distinction between true and counterfeit beliefs and practices. For example, Richard G. Ellsworth characterizes Saul's descent to evil in the context of the king having sought revelation through a witch. Quote, he had become a liar, an equivocator, a cheat, a thief, and a murderer. Now, confused in mind and darkened in spirit, he sought help from satanic sources, end quote. In similar fashion, David H. Yarn, Jr. reminds Ensign readers of Moses' deliverance of Israel and his warning to them against, quote, divination, enchanters, witches, consulters of familiar spirits, wizards, necromancers, and other abominations, end quote, contrasting such evil influences with the prophet which the Lord would raise up. Given these institutional attitudes about witchcraft and, quote, New Age, why would an LDS woman think of confessing to being a witch, and how could anyone see North American neo-pagan belief and practice as being in any way congruent with Mormonism? Moreover, to what extent is it possible to blend Mormon identities with self-identification as a pagan or witch? These questions of identity are my real overarching interests. After searching the internet for women who self-identified as having an LDS background and an interest in neo-paganism, I asked 13 women a series of questions relating to their experience of and feelings about Mormonism and paganism. I received 5 responses. I actually received others, but I was unable to reach them for confirmation, reconfirmation of their permission to use the data. The information I gathered then comes from a small sample representing women of different ages, different sexual orientations, and who are located all across the United States. I was particularly interested in discovering what aspect of paganism they were drawn to, how they were exposed to it, and what they found most appealing about it. In addition, I wanted to know what their spiritual practice looks like, especially if it contains any elements of Mormonism. In other words, I was interested in hearing about what, if anything, they find in paganism that is congruent with their understanding of Mormonism. Almost as an afterthought, and though I wasn't sure of its relevance, it seemed important to know if they had been born and raised LDS or if they were converts. Of the 5 women whose data I used, 3 were converts. Interestingly enough, further analysis revealed a distinction between converts and those who were born and raised LDS. The 2 generational Mormons were the only ones who had severed all ties to the church by actually having their names removed from church records. One woman who took this action reported that the decision to have her name removed was the first true adult decision she'd ever made regarding her own identity, all other previous decisions having been influenced by LDS culture. On the other hand, the LDS converts I interviewed were working to integrate and or reconcile their Mormon and pagan identities, perhaps because as converts they had already made a major conversion decision, and therefore experienced their religious identities as more fluid and accommodating. Beyond this division, the women located themselves on the spectrum of Mormon-pagan identity, either anywhere from quintessentially Mormon, more Mormon than pagan, hybrid Mormon-pagan, more pagan than Mormon, and quintessentially pagan. It is easy to hypothesize that these women would have been motivated to explore paganism because of a conscious desire to incorporate less hierarchical ideas into their religious lives. However, if the issue was only rejection of institutional authority, they could perhaps have simply left the church for an evangelical community, by definition non-hierarchical. Indeed, Barbara's family left the LDS church to become evangelical Christians. Thus, both parents and child rejected LDS church structure, though in radically different ways. My overarching question was to ascertain what are the dominant pieces, the key attributes of Mormon identity, and which of these are maintained, broken, and or reconstructed in these women's religious lives. Put another way, is there something quintessentially Mormon that follows people through the changes they make in response to their own religious needs? The 2 elements of identity that surface repeatedly as I talk to these women are that of testimony and community. The communal and social aspects of Mormonism are the environment in which one's personal testimony gets articulated and refined, and in which Mormon identity is negotiated through communal agreements. One communal agreement or testimony has to do with Heavenly Mother. The LDS community agrees that she exists, but is also tacitly agrees that attempts to draw attention to that knowledge or to worship her in any way is a breach of the boundary, the distinction between true and false religion. Based on reports that interest in and a hunger for devotion to the goddess is what drives the New Age market and the increased conversion to Wicca and other earth-based and mystery religions, I suspected that these women would report having a testimony of the existence of Heavenly Mother as a driving force in their hybrid spirituality. This did turn out to be the case, as every respondent noted the desire to know and develop a relationship with the Mother in Heaven, as well as frustration at the Church's position on her role in their lives. Their personal identities seem to be linked to hers, even for those who no longer subscribe to the LDS notion of heaven or think of her as a perfected anthropomorphic being, still consider the goddess to have something to do with them, as if knowing her in whatever form has something to do with knowing themselves. Every respondent considered Heavenly Mother to be the aspect of pagan belief and practice most congruent with Mormonism. Barbara notes that, quote, although I do not personify the divine feminine, when I use a name for the divine feminine, such as Asherah, an ancient Syrian goddess, I picture a symbol of that aspect which I'm trying to connect to, not a specific face or form. I do see that this is where my ideas about her got started, albeit in a very structured form, end quote. Trina states that she too believes, quote, that Heavenly Mother Goddess is beautiful and a very big part of life. I also believe that when the church states that there is more truth that hasn't come to light, but we're not ready for it yet, it's about Goddess. It's about pagan practices. It's about worshiping them as parents. My kids will have both God and goddess in their lives. My older kids are aware of goddess, and my oldest daughter is leaning toward Wicca, end quote. Charlotte says that she has, quote, always seen Heavenly Mother as completely beautiful and powerful, like a wonderful, wise, and gorgeous queen. In the temple, when we think of what we may become, I envision being powerful, beautiful, and wise, just like her, filled with light and love, brilliant beyond words. I do wish we would focus on her more in church. Trina also argues, I think there are many other LDS women who believe and wish they could pray to Goddess, but don't have the guts or knowledge that would allow them to do so. This insight came to her after Mother's Day last year when she gave the Relief Society closing prayer and, quote, wished our Heavenly Mother, Goddess, a happy Mother's Day. I heard a few gasps, she said, but after the prayer, I had several women thank me for it. I've never seen anyone thank others for a closing prayer before. Trish is also concerned about her children not having to wait until their 40s to, quote, realize the fullness of the truth, end quote. Charlotte reports that recently her Relief Society had a lengthy discussion about Heavenly Mother. We all spoke of why she isn't discussed much. We came up with a feeling that Father wants to protect her from mockery, like when people take the name of God in vain or curse and swear. She told another sister about seeing the goddess, quote, seeing the goddess, and she says, is on the same path. Both women agree that their paths are right, presumably meaning true, as opposed to false religion, and both feel that they need to, quote, bring this out more into the church with respect to her sacredness, end quote. Charlotte, like most of the other women, wear pentacles as a symbol of their commitment to their path and their relationship with the goddess. Quote, I have a charm bracelet I wear. It has a pentagram with the tree of life intertwined. It has the goddess, and it has a bumblebee. I wear it to church without worry because I know in my heart that those who would pass judgment are just ignorant of what can be, what other pieces of truth are waiting for us to find, end quote. Jane, who is openly affiliated with a Wiccan coven, also identifies the presence of a goddess as being the most congruent thread running through both traditions. Because she is gay, she is also grateful for the pagan community's embrace of her homosexuality, the issue for which she removed her name from the church records. She envisions deity as a father and mother together and has most recently decided to return to church in an effort to more hybridize her identity. She considers herself a very spiritual person and believes, quote, that the pagan Wiccan Mormon path is the right place for me at this time, end quote. She wants to be a hybrid Mormon pagan, but right now identifies herself as being more pagan than Mormon. She sees Wicca as being the aspect of her life that is least compatible with her Mormon desires. At this point, I haven't established whether that has to do with the fact that this is an actual affiliation, a joining of something, or if she thinks that witchcraft itself is the part that is incongruent. Charlotte doesn't experience that problem. She reports having a temple recommend and being active in the LDS church, so is the respondent whose identity is the most hybrid. In fact, her argument that paganism is absolutely congruent with Mormonism is based on the notion that Mormonism contains the whole, is the container for all truth. Or perhaps it would be more accurate to say that Mormonism and paganism are two shadows cast by the same truth, truth with a capital T. With regard to human identity, she states, I believe we can all be little mini prophets of our own, and if we would just believe in ourselves and in the possibility of miracles, we all can be so inspired and magical. We have that divine heritage. We should be magical. Similarly, Trina feels that the presence of pentacles on LDS temples and other institutional but public buildings confirms her belief that Mormonism is true while validating her chosen hybrid Mormon-pagan path. Barbara is at the other end of the spectrum. She situates herself, quote, somewhere between more pagan than Mormon and quintessentially pagan. I am a pagan. I don't really identify myself as Mormon per se, but my experiences as a Mormon led me to this moment, so I have to at least acknowledge that part of my life, end quote. Most notably, she confirmed another of my suspicions when she acknowledged being, quote, a curious outsider who was once an insider, end quote. Despite the fact that she hasn't stayed connected to the church, even marginally, and has no idea what progress the church has made in any area, she recognizes that her paganism is nevertheless informed by her Mormon identity. Quote, I still feel that there is a whole part of my life that only other Mormons and ex-Mormons will ever understand. I lived 20 years as a part of that community. I cannot completely erase those experiences, end quote. Sue, who is an active, thinks of herself as more pagan than Mormon. Her main concern was with what she perceived to be the failure of both the LDS Church and its local community to truly see and address her and her family's social, physical, and spiritual needs. She and her husband have both become involved in heathenism, a cultural tradition informed by Nordic myths and reconstructed practices. Though Joanna Pearson notes that some scholars and most heathens argue that heathenism is something other than pagan, Sarah identifies herself as pagan. Heathenism's emphasis on family and nature, ancestral links, and conservative values are what attracts her to this community. The community, she argues, has been much more responsive than the LDS community. The outcome of her interactions with other heathens is the perception that their relationships are more truly reciprocal, generated by what she perceives to be genuine concern. On the other hand, her experience of Mormon community has been based on the anxiety and guilt produced by fulfilling communal responsibilities, the completion of which generate the Mormon version of religious merit that ultimately leads to exaltation, as opposed to genuine reciprocity and compassion. At the same time, Sarah has other problems with Mormonism that seem insurmountable, particularly with regard to its history. An emphasis on history is another common thread in both Mormon and pagan identity, particularly for goddess spirituality. However, both populations have vastly different ways of approaching the issue. According to Pearson, part of the witch identity is based on what witches call the burning times, referring to the millions of women who died in the religiously motivated witch hunts. This identity construction involves the conscious, quote, repackaging of history in which, quote, memories of the past are thus focused on as a central source of meaning, with the burning times used as a rallying symbol and the witch regarded both as martyr and as a representation of repressed female power, end quote. This is not unlike Mormon history, which functions as LDS theology. In other words, both witches and Mormons identify with an historic chain of memory based on persecution. Unlike Mormons, however, witches admit to the problems inherent in such an interpretation of history, noting that the truth of the numbers dead is unimportant, as is the actual existence of an ancient goddess-worshipping matriarchy. Rather, what matters to them is the recognition of a shared identity and the function of the myth in their lives. In other words, to be a witch, to a witch, being true and being factual do not have to be coterminous. It is no surprise, then, that the LDS Church's insistence on the historicity of the Book of Mormon and on standardized and simplified Mormon history as literal truth is one element that almost all of these women find distasteful about Mormonism. Another common thread between all five respondents is their emphasis on the validity of their own experience as the ultimate authority and the rejection of institutional authority as a mediator or judge of their spiritual experiences and choices. Even Charlotte, who regularly attends the temple, insists that being Mormon is not what is most important about one's spiritual path, but rather being true to one's intuition, quote, the whispering of one's heart, end quote. She says, you can be a witch in LDS or not LDS, which suggests that being Mormon is less relevant than being aware of one's divine potential, which for her, ultimately, is magical. In terms of spiritual practice, each of these women engages in the same core practices, the wearing of pentacles, altar construction and maintenance, meditation, prayer to God and the goddess, and the practice of some form of divination. Beyond that, Charlotte attends the temple. For 10 years, Barbara has belonged to a Unitarian Universalist congregation and participated in their pagan circle and has recently joined a coven. Trina is learning to do spell work and does rituals at her altar, and Sue has begun attending heathen hearths with her family. Jane reports celebrating the Sabbaths and full moons with her coven, and she also has her own smaller circle that celebrates the Sabbaths, full moons, and dark moons when they can. In addition, she has been attending the LDS Church again so as to return to some sort of public Mormon identity. All of the women reflect a common motif of pagan Wiccan conversion and identity, intellectualism. Though studies show that the intellectual motif is uncommon in other religious traditions, it is strong in Wicca. Part of this trend has to do with the fact that these traditions are highly literate. However, one also has to be open to religious alternatives in the first place and to put time and effort into searching for a community to join. These women conform to studies that suggest that Wiccans don't just go straight from Christianity to paganism. They have to search and think and work it out. According to Pearson, quote, modern paganism depends to a great extent upon the literate world, so that fluency is obtained almost entirely through books, internet, and other media. Indeed, all of these women indicate that they consider reading and study of such things as Wicca, herbalism, or Celtic myth an essential part of their spiritual practice. Like becoming Mormon, becoming a pagan is an ongoing reconstruction of identity. Both pagan and Mormon identities are complex, contradictory, and confusing. For instance, images specific to the witch include the belief that witches can be strong, independent, powerful, guardians of nature, practitioners of magic and spell work, that they are able to recognize light and dark, that they are priestesses to the goddess, they are herbalists, that witches come to recognize, rather than convert, they come to recognize themselves as witches or pagans. They become a witch through the intellectual, mystical, and recognition, conversion motifs. In terms of Mormon identity, they defy patriarchal authority, and they most often are university-educated. And in the United States, they are 2-to-1 female. In terms of Mormon identity, Mormons recognize multiple gods and goddesses, but only worship one God. They identify, like pagans and Wiccans, with past persecution chain of memory. They're strongly tied to patriarchal authority, but recognize individual authority to some extent. And in the U.S., like the other population, are most likely university educated. Pagan and Mormon identities have been outside the mainstream, and both groups have been simultaneously engaged in a process of identity rehabilitation. It wasn't so long ago that identifying oneself as a Mormon could generate suspicion and contempt. The same, of course, is still true for pagans. Both traditions still raise eyebrows, though both are transcending stereotypes about their goals and places in society. In the context of our emphasis, my emphasis here, this paper is just a tease. I still know really very little about these women and others like them. I'm making contacts all over the country with independent bookshops, New Age and others, and women's groups who suggest that this Mormon-pagan hybridity is not as rare as one might think. As I said earlier, Heavenly Mother was the thread that bound these women to their experience of Mormonism and informed their religious and spiritual practices, regardless of their relationship to the LDS Church. In addition, I found to my surprise that another thread between them was the failure of the LDS community, the thing that the Church does best, for which it is known, and for which it takes the most pride. Their fellow Latter-day Saints were incapable, not necessarily because they didn't want to, but because they didn't know how to respond to whatever distinguished them from other ward members, whether it was financial problems, questions of church history, or the desire to know Mother in Heaven. So I guess that's pretty much what I have to say. I'd like to finish up, though, by saying that I constantly have students who come to me. I teach a course in Mormonism and in new religious movements at Arizona State University, and I routinely have students come to me and say, you know, I was raised Mormon, because we study Mormonism and we study paganism, and so... And they'll identify themselves as doing this thing, and I found on just doing some research the other night, found a gentleman who says he's writing. And what's interesting to me is that it appears to be a man. I mean, the name could be deceptive, but someone seems to be doing writing a book. And I'm like, no, I'm doing that. That's my. But he says he's looking for, you know, he's soliciting information from stories from people who were raised Mormon or who were Mormon and are now pagan. And so I'm not the only person who's interested in this and who sees that there seems to be something happening here. One evangelical Christian, his name escapes me for the moment, but he's one of these popular kinds of writers and speakers, and he rather histrionically, identified paganism, neo-paganism, or Wicca, maybe, as says that it will soon be the third largest, or one of the three top religions in America. And, of course, he sees that as a threat. He's not saying, oh, look at this. This is really interesting. He's saying, we really better. So his website is called The Power of the Witch, or something like that. I've got it. I can tell you about it if you're interested. And it's his is basically a response to the Harry Potter books, and so it is growing. It's really hard because, you know, there are not very many institutions. It's not institutionalized the way Mormonism and other groups are, but it's difficult to know about numbers. But something is really happening here, and it's interesting to see Mormons becoming interested in this tradition.
I'm grateful for the opportunity that I have to respond to Doe. I've been a big fan of her since we met at a AAR, American Academy of Religion Regional Conference several years back, and you gave... but Doe has been a dear friend and a mentor since then. I was intrigued by the themes of religious syncretization and hybridization of religious identity that was running through Doe's presentation, and so for that reason, I'm gonna focus more on this syncretism rather than on paganism per se. I don't have much experience or background in that area. A little bit of a brief explanation. I'm My heritage is Japanese. I spent several years growing up in my mother's hometown in Japan. And the Japanese are very good at this religious syncretism. They're very good at mixing and hybridizing religious traditions. They say that you're born Shinto and die a Buddhist. And to explain, when Japanese babies are born into the world, they're taken to the Shinto shrine to be blessed. And when you die, you almost always have a Buddhist funeral in Japan. And now there's this actually a trend to have Christian weddings in Christian chapels with Christian ministers. And so you could say that you're born Shinto, marry Christian, die Buddhist in Japan. And this has affected my own worship and religious repertoire. So I've incorporated elements of my own Japanese upbringing into my religious repertoire. I guess I'm kind of a Budo Shinto Mormon, I guess. I'm also a graduate student of comparative religions, and I'm trained to tease out valuable insights by putting similar phenomena from different traditions side by side. One of my areas of expertise is Japanese religions, so I hope you'll bear with me as I share a story of religious syncretism from my own studies. When the Jesuit missionaries entered Japan in the 16th century, they had considerable success converting thousands of Japanese, both peasants and feudal lords, to Catholic Christianity. The shogun, feeling threatened, eventually outlawed Christianity and forced the Japanese converts to recant or die. Many chose to die by crucifixion or burning at the stake rather than participate in the act of denunciation by physically stepping on fumie, which is an image of Mary and or Jesus. They would line up members of a village and watch as they tried. They would march them over these icons of Jesus and Mary, and if they hesitated or if they refused to step on it, then they would pull them out as a Christian and you generally execute them. The government eventually required all Japanese families to declare allegiance to local Buddhist temples as a sign of their continued aversion to Christianity. A few small groups continued to practice their faith in secret, however. These were called Kakure Kirishitan, or hidden Christians. One of their survival tactics was to set up altars to Mary and to the Christ child in the guise of the Buddhist goddess of compassion, Kannon, who's known in China as Guanyin. She's often depicted cradling a small child, and she has, you know, robes over her. She looks a lot like the Virgin Mary. They also use statues of the Bodhisattva Jizo as a substitute for Jesus. Jizo is a very Christ-like figure who descends into hell to take on the sufferings of penitent sinners and lets them escape into heaven. So when the ban on Christianity was removed in the 1860s, after 2.5 centuries of prohibition, many of the Kakure Kirishitan returned to the Catholic Church. Others, however, refused to recognize the authority of the Church over them and continue to this day to practice their own unique form of hybridized esoteric Christian Buddhism. So what can we learn from comparing the syncretism of the Mormo pagan women that Do talked about and the Kakure Kirishitan? One of the things that occurs to me is that syncretism is a source of empowerment to both groups, particularly in the case of the Japanese Christians, empowered them to survive. Rather than accept the limited choices presented to them by the authority structure, syncretism allows for the creation of additional options. Instead of recantation or death, the Kakure Kirishitan created a third option that allowed them to believe and live. Instead of being forced to choose between Mormonism and paganism, the Mormo-pagan women interviewed by Doe found a way to worship both God and the goddess and to retain their self-identities as Mormons and pagans. So this might be another answer to the question of why Mormon women are drawn to neo-paganism and choose this particular response to it. It was interesting to me that Mormon women found that they could get closer to Mother in Heaven through sources outside of the church. Once again, I looked for other examples of this sort of phenomenon. Was there another instance of Mormon women in a patriarchal religion turning to an external source for access to the divine feminine? I found my answer in the veneration of Virgin Mary by Muslims. The next quote is from Life magazine, December 1996. "One of the most intriguing aspects of the latest rise of Mary is this. The emotional need for her so is irresistible to a troubled world that people... The emotional need for her is so irresistible to a troubled world that people without an obvious link to the Virgin are being drawn to her. It's not news that Muslims revere Mary as a pure and holy saint. She's mentioned 34 times in the Quran, which upholds her virginal conception of Jesus. But to see large numbers of Muslims making pilgrimages to Christian Marian shrines is a remarkable thing. Interdenominational Marian prayer groups are springing up throughout the world." And again, I know this isn't a pagan example, but I'd like to explore this a little bit because this resonates with me particularly. I'm a non-Catholic who's also drawn to Mary. I feel in my own life a heavenly mother-shaped hole in my spiritual life. I ache for the divine feminine. I've experimented with different methods of filling this need, and have recently settled on a tentative devotion to the Catholic Mary. I try to end each day by praying the rosary. And this is, in fact, influenced by some of my Buddhist worship as well. I'm used to praying with Buddhist beads and doing mantras, and that helps me with my spiritual discipline. When I was driving in traffic yesterday and feeling very frustrated, I whispered to myself the central prayer of the Catholic Rosary until I felt at peace again. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. I've said that prayer countless times, so I still feel power and a yearning when I say the words, Holy Mary, Mother of God. There's something powerful about calling out to a divine mother that I can't quite articulate. And I'm exercising some of the same consciousness of narrative creation that some of the Mormo-pagan women are. I don't imagine Mary as someone who's, you know, effectively praying for me or anything, but there's something about that imagery I say here, I can't quite articulate it, that there is something very powerful about that I find appealing. And I've incorporated that into my spiritual practice. I hope you don't mind if I share one more Marian prayer. This one is called the Priest's Prayer of Self-Dedication to Mary. Most Holy Virgin Mary, perfect disciple of Jesus, I come to dedicate my life and my priestly ministry to your Immaculate Heart. I desire to abandon myself to the will of Jesus, your Son, and walk in faith with you, my Mother. To you I consecrate my life in the priesthood. I give you every gift I possess of nature and of grace, my body and my soul, all that I own and everything I do. Pray for me that the Holy Spirit may visit me with his many gifts. Pray for me that by faith I may know the power of Christ and by love make him present in the world. Amen. Many Catholic priests around the world choose to begin their days with this prayer. I've thought about adding it to my own tool bag of spiritual practices, of possibly starting out each day with a similar dedication. And I think this is interesting, too, because, I mean, the Catholic Church isn't known for its... it has issues with empowering women. But here's one of the ways that hole for the divine feminine is filled. So I might have to add Marian Catholic to my growing syncretistic religious self-identity labels. But I am grateful for the extra options I have for considering the divine feminine through my own deliberate syncretism. I feel empowered. And I'm curious, too, to bring it back to Mormons in general, about how many converts from Catholicism, especially in Latin American countries, find ways to incorporate veneration of Mary into their religious practice. I've read several studies about religious syncretism between Mormons and there's a great article in Dialogue on Haitian Mormonism and Voodoo. There's another one on Guatemalan Mormonism, but I haven't seen anything about Catholic Mormon syncretism. So through reflection on Doe's interviews and her observations and on my own experiences and studies, I've come to this tentative conclusion. The religiously marginalized turn to syncretism for spiritual empowerment. Through negotiation and hybridization, they're able to carve out a sacred space where they can live a spiritual life that is authentic to their experience. I didn't talk about these examples, but it's in the space that the slaves were able to incorporate West African ritual, rhythmic, ecstatic states into their Christian worship, and that survives to this day. And that Haitian Mormons can continue to practice voodoo, something that actually the church has not tried to... There is no written policy to stamp out that. They're instead kind of leaving it up to the locals. That the Kakure Kirishitan, in this space, the Kakure Kirishitan can continue to worship Jesus, and that Mormon pagan women can venerate the goddess.
Okay, we have a few minutes where we can take questions from the audience for Doe. So if you have a question, you can go ahead and walk up here and ask it to the microphone, or just say it out loud and I'll repeat it into the mic so we can get on the recording.
Be able to do that.
Okay, so the question is about someone who considers himself a Mormon pagan and also is a temple recommend holder and is able to maintain a temple recommend, and how does she do that?
Well, she's not, where she wears a pentacle, she's the one who wears the pentacle every week and, I mean, you know, wears the jewelry and stuff. Presumably it's not so identifiable that, I mean, she doesn't, like, go to her bishop in her temple recommend. She doesn't consider there to be any incongruity, so when she answers those questions, she's not lying about, you know, she believes that, she said, Joseph Smith's, the heritage that what we inherit from Joseph Smith is magic. That's what she said. She said, so she sees no incongruity, so she just doesn't have anything to confess.
One thing that struck me as interesting is that Mormonism creates this space where you have two sources of truth, right? You have authoritative sources, whether it's scripture or the church hierarchy, but you also have this reliance on personal experience, right? And I think this may be unique when you compare it to other religions out there where they might focus more on one or the other. And so it creates a tension sometimes. It's, I think, maybe the bulk of church membership finds that their personal experience reinforces the authoritative truth, right? But it also leaves a space where there can be a tension between authoritative discourse and personal experience, where they can be there can be a disconnect between the two, and members are forced to find a way to harmonize or to reconcile the two. And this strikes me as one of those situations.
And what I have learned, I'm 50 now, and I'm just learning so much. I have met so many people. I always took everything any church leader said so seriously. So if I read this home teacher's or this visiting teacher's response in the Ensign, I would think that was scripture. I would think, oh my gosh, I'm doing something terrible. But in fact, most members of the church that I know, that I've met over the last 35 years of being LDS, they really don't take those things seriously. I mean, unless the prophet comes out and says something really specifically, they rely more on their, the people that I have met tend to rely more on that experience, their own experience, their own feeling of integrity of their practice. And they just don't even go there. They don't get caught up in all that, you know, worries about that in the Ensign there was this obscure visiting teacher that said this thing or quoted a 70 or an apostle or whatever. Unless it's just really made explicit, they figure they're on their own. I'm like, dang, I wish I could have done that from the beginning. I probably wouldn't be in such bad shape now. Yeah, I mean, we want to know the proof, you know. People want to know the proof. They want to know, okay, who said that? Well, was he prophet when he said that? You know, I mean, and you can call that equivocation, you can call it whatever you want, but we really are committed to this principle of individual integrity and autonomy and revelation. We think we should be able to get it.
I missed the title if you have it.
It's on the, you can, I didn't actually write it, this is very, I didn't write it down, but it's, you can find it on the church's website.
Okay.
Not Church's website, on Sunstone website. I mean, the reference to it and... yeah, the efficacy of the ordinances. And is it? Oh, okay. Well, I found it on Sunstone, so it must have been delivered at Sunstone, too. So, yeah.
Okay. I think we have maybe time for one more quick question, or anyone with a burning question? I maybe have a question for you, Doe. Can you, I know you've presented this paper at other Sunstone symposiums in the past. Would you care to comment, just maybe as a closing comment, like how this has been received, or maybe share an experience that you've had after presenting this paper, and then we'll go ahead and close.
Well, how I ended the time in Salt Lake when I delivered this paper the first time, I said any women who are interested in in any of these topics, are concerned with these issues, please contact me. And I had several women come up afterwards. Right after that, then, I became aware of the Human Subjects Review Board. And so I thought, you know, I can't use any of this stuff in my dissertation, but... So I need to put together kind of, and this was just very, I mean, this was not in relationship to any paper I did for my coursework or anything. It was just something I did during the summer that I thought I wanted to pursue. And so, yeah, I never did contact any of those people. And I'm really embarrassed because they were very eager to discuss it. And actually, when I've sat on the New Age panels, we've had people stay after and really want to talk and really want to, find some sort of community, because like these Mormon women that I talked with are saying, the Mormon component of their experience, no one else can understand that. And so there's this need to find some sort of a community, some sort of a, create some sort of room for discourse and community with other Mormons.
Thank you, Doe, and thank you, John, for a fabulous session.
Thanks.